and welcome back to Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to all things related to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. This is episode 101. My name is Adam Reichert. I am one of the co-hosts of the podcast, and with me is Agnieszka Widłaszewska, the other co-host. Hi, Aga.
Hi, Adam, and hello, listeners.
So today we are going to talk about a very important process which is taking place in parallel with the war in Ukraine, and that's looking at three members of the Eastern Partnership Program have submitted their applications to become members, at least candidate members, of the European Union. This is actually a huge development, one that was, I think, a little bit unexpected. But since the invasion, Russian invasion, full-scale invasion on February 24th, which is now already over 3 months, has taken place. It accelerated the process of certain countries that are interested in becoming member states of the European Union. And these three countries are, of course, Ukraine, but also Moldova and Georgia. So we have a special conversation with two experts, one who is an expert on Eastern Partnership and especially civil society cooperation, as well as an expert from Ukraine. But before we get into that, Agnieszka, maybe we can just say a few words about some more context of our discussion today and what will lead us into our discussion.
Yes, definitely. I think maybe just a little bit of introduction to what the Eastern Partnership is to those for those of our listeners who might not be as familiar with it. So it's an EU initiative cooperation format, if you will, that was created back in 2009 in order to foster cooperation with the EU's Eastern European partners. And so the initiative includes six members. Well, now, in a way, five, but we'll get to that. Yeah. So it started with six members, and that was Belarus, Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. And it's sort of a relatively loose type of cooperation. It's more sort of just a general overarching framework for it, but still the EU has very much a bilateral relationship with each of these countries and different types of agreements that we don't necessarily need to go into at this point in time, but it was just to have this more regional framework so that these countries can also exchange information and cooperate with the EU. Since then, there has been obviously a lot of ups and downs and a lot of developments in the region. Currently, the status of Belarus is a bit sort of, it's suspended officially. Well, Belarus officially suspended its membership, but of course the EU wants to continue to cooperate with the people of Belarus and with the Belarusian civil society. So the status of Belarus is sort of to be discussed or to be determined in the future. But yes, as we said, the sort of the pace and the level of cooperation between the EU and these different countries has been very much different. And right now we can see that there are these three countries who have sort of jumped ahead of the other three and have actually applied for membership in the EU. And so we will discuss, indeed, during the interview with our guests, we will discuss the question of how does that impact Eastern Partnership as an initiative? Does that mean that it should cease to exist, that these countries should stop being members of this initiative, that it should be just left with the other three, or maybe just gotten rid of altogether? And I think it's an interesting discussion to be had, and I hope that our listeners will enjoy our exchange of views with our guests on that topic.
Yes, and this for those listeners who are kind of been with us for a while, Eastern Partnership is nothing new to Talk Eastern Europe, but as well as New Eastern Europe, we've been covering it on our pages since we've launched New Eastern Europe as a magazine, and I think even 2019 we did a special edition of New Eastern Europe, which was celebrating the 10 years of Eastern Partnership. We'll link to some of these other resources online. It's really, sometimes can get very complicated how the EU policy towards its neighbors works. And we try to break it down in ways that's more understandable. And in fact, Agnieszka, I don't know if you remember or not, but it was like as you were joining us here at Talk Eastern Europe in early February before the invasion in Ukraine, we did an episode with Mikhail Hovhannisyan about Eastern Partnership looking to the future, and none of these topics which we are talking about today were even brought up because nobody had expected that Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova would push for EU candidate status. So it just shows how much has changed even in the matter of the last 3 months or so, and particularly as you mentioned, Eastern Partnership is a really important program, but now everything is in the air. We don't know what's going to happen with these developments, with Belarus basically saying they're out, they don't want to be a part of it anymore, with the three countries that have applied for EU membership status. Armenia kind of is like looking for a way to keep some good relations with the EU, but it's also under a strong influence from Russia, and Azerbaijan is interested in having good relations with the EU, but also not interested in, you know, looking towards a more either even association agreement, but even having, you know, of course, becoming a member of the EU is not in their interest, as far as they have been clear in their policies. So I think there's a lot to talk about even beyond this episode, but this is a great, I think, beginning of the discussion of what the Eastern Partnership is, where it's heading, and what these developments mean for it. And before we get into our discussion, I do want to mention that it is done in partnership with the EU's Eastern Partnership Civil Society Forum. It's a special forum which connects different civil society organizations from Eastern Partnership states, as well as the European Union. It's been around since the Eastern Partnership launched, and it has done a lot of great work in supporting NGOs and the development of civil society, and monitoring, of course, also the developments in these countries.
Yes, and I think maybe it's just worth mentioning that we have done some episodes with them before. It's not the first, episode in terms of this cooperation. So we can also link these episodes in the description, and hopefully we will continue this really nice cooperation with them in the future to continue this discussion on the Eastern Partnership.
Yes. So special thank you and shout out to them as well. Okay. So maybe with that, let me just say that I will introduce our interviewees as the interview starts, but we will in a moment be speaking with Tanya Marocki, who is with the Eastern Partnership Civil Society Forum, as well as Sergei Gerasimchuk, who is based in Kiev at the Foreign Policy Council Ukrainian PRISM. Okay, and welcome back now to our program. We are joined here by Tanya Marocki, who is the EAP Index Manager at the Eastern Partnership Civil Society Forum, where she leads the production of the EAP Index, a monitoring tool which looks at the progress made by the six Eastern Partnership countries towards sustainable democratic development and European integration, as well as Sergei Gerasimchuk, who is the Deputy Executive Director and Regional Initiatives and Neighborhood Program Director at the Foreign Policy Council Ukrainian PRISM in Kiev. Hello to you both and welcome.
Hi.
Hi, Adam. Thank you for having me.
So I think we would like to start maybe, Tanya, with you and kind of get an overall introduction to the situation that we are facing when it comes to looking at the associated trio, which is Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia, the three countries of the Eastern Partnership who have signed association agreements and now have all submitted their applications for membership to the European Union. So, Tanya, as head of the EAP Index, which is monitoring, as I mentioned, the progress of these countries, maybe you could start by telling our listeners a bit more about the index itself, what it is based on, what criteria you use, and then maybe go into a little bit of discussion on how you assess the readiness of these countries, the associated trio, to join the EU from the current state of affairs, and maybe not yet taking into account the war in Ukraine, because I think we'll get into that in a moment.
Yes, thank you. So the Eastern Partnership Index, what is it and what does it measure? It is a tool that the EAPCSF has been producing since 2015. So we have quite a number of years covered and enough to show some trends already and some major observations and findings. And this comes quite handy now in the current situation when the EU candidate status is being discussed and we are looking into how already the EAP countries are, well, the associated trio is to possibly obtain EU candidate status. The index looks, as you rightly mentioned, into how the countries are approximating to UN international standards when it comes to rule of law, democracy, but also convergence towards EU policies. So it really follows the Eastern Partnership Association agenda, so to speak, the association agenda for the associated trio, but in general, all the areas that are covered by the Eastern Partnership. It does this assessment by submitting a questionnaire to over 50 experts who answer the questions with a yes or no answers that gets translated into a score. And the questionnaire is designed specifically to assess both law progress, but also practice. Mm. So we try to make sure that we have a fair assessment. How well is it going in terms of adoption of new laws, but also how things are actually in the practice at the implementation level. As we also saw that often the problem lies between these two levels. When it comes to the difficult question of how we assess the readiness of the associated trio to join the EU and, well, to obtain EU candidate status, the index gives us quite an important insight. And it's very interesting because it gives us a composite picture of the state of development of the trio. The first thing that I would say is that since we have been doing this monitoring since 2015 and we can see trends, we can see that Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia have already cemented considerable normative and legal approximation to the EU. So the trend is one of approximation, but also of convergence. So especially in the areas of freedom, security, and justice, but also environment and climate policy, we see increased levels of convergence with the EU. Mm-hmm. So these are positive developments. Mm-hmm. This is at the macro level, let's say. So this also means that we see steady improvement when it comes to moving closer to the standards that are set out in the Copenhagen criteria. So a functioning market economy, stable democracy, rule of law, and also capacity to implement all the EU legislation. This being said, things are obviously not perfect. So there are a number of problems with what concerns especially implementation. This is most notable in the area of independent judiciary and fight against corruption. But we see that in these areas particularly, progress is not linear. So we see maybe progress that is then followed by backsliding or stagnation. Mm. So when you look into the details, it's not a linear upward trend, but rather a motion that moves one step forward, two step backwards, sometimes two step forward and one step backward. Mm. Yes, so this is at a more detailed level, zooming in into rather different policy areas. What I think is important when we try to assess their readiness to obtain EU candidate status or not, is two things. First of all, that we're talking mainly about a political decision, which should not be too far removed from the situation in the ground, obviously, but it is ultimately a political decision. The reason why we're discussing this now is because of political development, not policy development. And stemming from this is the fact that since we're talking at the political level, we're also talking about the importance of offering a EU, more concrete EU perspective to the associated trio. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important also to move the discussion, to discuss, of course, how's the situation on the ground, look at concretely what is the state of play. But we also know that there is a EU questionnaire that the countries have filled. But this assessment is very hard to make, because how do you assess qualitatively great progress in one area and then average progress in another and very bad a bad situation in one area? Does the good progress offset lack of progress in another area? So I think this is it's very important to keep in mind that, as I said, it's a political decision, and the European perspective, the possibility to offer European perspective to the trio is quite important and really what's at stake now, especially for how it's going to be perceived by the local decision making community, but also by the people, by the citizens of Moldova, Georgia, and Ukraine. And and I think considering and the EU candidate status for the trio and offering this perspective has it would be a gesture of a very important symbolic and practical value. It would recognize that the Eastern Partnership has delivered substantial results. So it would also send a positive message in that sense. It would give a firmer foothold to the EU reforms because it would also anchor the progress to a specific, meaningful end goal. By this, it would make also EU conditionality possibly more effective because it changes the EU the EU institutional mandate towards the countries. And lastly, it also, I think, raises the chances of securing core governance-related reforms that underpin the Copenhagen criteria and that are also the area in which the EAP countries and including especially Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine have been struggling to really achieve sustainable progress.
Thank you. I think some of these issues we will touch on more during our discussion.
Yes. So, Serhii, I wanted to go to you now and ask about Ukraine more specifically. Tanya mentioned that the current events and the membership application was motivated by a political event. We could even say a geopolitical event, right? So how important do you think is it from the Ukrainian perspective that it applied precisely now during the war when it is being under Russian invasion? And what, in your opinion, motivated this decision? And perhaps similarly, if you then have a bit of time to try to answer the same question for Moldova and Georgia, why, what motivated them to apply together with Ukraine at this point in time?
Thank you very much, Agnieszka, for your question. And let me start with the remark that it's always geopolitically in this part of the world, since we have the neighbor which thinks in geopolitical categories, I mean Russia. And if your neighbor thinks in geopolitical categories and tries to expand by methods of the 19th century, then obviously you have to consider that and you have to think about the answer to such a challenge. And basically, it was the geopolitical choice of Ukraine back in 2004, 2005, when Ukrainians voted for Yushchenko because it was voting for European future of Ukraine, for pro-European and pro-Western candidate. It was European choice of Ukraine back in 2014, during the Revolution of Dignity, when Ukrainians again fought for association agreement, because the first trigger for the Euromaidan, for the Revolution of Dignity, was the association agreement with the European Union. And of course, it's more than clear that nowadays it's also European choice of Ukraine, because instead of giving up to Russia and remaining in the Russian sphere of influence, which is a nice synonym to Russian pressure and Russian power. Instead of that, the Ukrainians decided to fight for European choice. Speaking about the Eastern Partnership in this regard, to some extent, if we go back to history and look at Eastern Partnership, it was sort of substitute to European neighborhood policy for those countries who deserve more and who want more, who have the ambition to gain more from the integration process. Moreover, to some extent, it was sort of limbo or sort of purgatory, whatever you call it, for the souls which are not bad enough to go to hell with Russia, but not good enough to join the heaven with the European Union. But now it's more or less clear that the price has been paid and there is a high demand for European integration. There is a high desire for European integration. Of course, it is to some extent interconnected, the emotions and the reality. Emotionally, many Ukrainians do want to move forward. If we speak about it from the rational point of view, we should also remember that the European Union, it's not only about emotions, otherwise it would never exist. It's also about norms, policies, and practices. But those norms, policies, and practices created for the EU such an attractive image, such a soft power gravity, that, of course, people who deal with the European integration do understand that there is necessity to proceed with these reforms. And I'm quite impressed with the fact that even now, under shelling, under missile shelling, the reforms are ongoing. As far as I'm concerned, there is still the reform of judiciary, which is ongoing in Ukraine, and we are trying to make progress. There is still the reform of decentralization in Ukraine. It is ongoing, and we are trying to achieve some progress in this regard. The institutions proved to be resilient because you can imagine the country is in war, the country is under constant attack, but people still think about reforms, people still think about European integration path, people still are able to fill the questionnaire and to focus on the questionnaire instead of focusing on the places where to hide from the missiles. It proves a lot that there is a political will to proceed with these reforms and to gain some success. Moreover, I do believe that it's very important to consider public opinion not only in Ukraine, but also in the EU. And nowadays, it is very favorable towards Ukraine, and the EU barometer says a lot about that. It's favorable not only in the friendly neighboring countries, which always supported Ukrainian integration, but now the so-called old Europe also woke up and looked at Ukraine with more readiness to accept Ukrainian ambitions for integration. So it's a very good moment for the political decision as well. And the desire to obtain the status of the candidate obviously doesn't mean that Ukraine will become a member state in one day or in one year. So there is anyway place for and time for reforms, for improvements, which can be negotiated with the European Union. And that makes very feasible, I believe, the decision to provide Ukraine with such a status of the candidate. And it will satisfy the demand both in Ukraine, in the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, and it will also correspond with the support which is expressed by the population of the Western Europe. Speaking about Georgia and Moldova, well, there is sort of a bit ambivalent assessment of their decision to follow the Ukrainian example and to apply with their applications. On the one hand, there were some comments from the Ukrainian leadership, including Minister of Foreign Affairs Kuleba, who said that it's sort of attempt to free ride and to apply for candidacy following Ukraine, which pays the price. I do know that my colleagues in Georgia and in the Republic of Moldova also complained that it was not free riding in such a definition. It was some of the politicians in both countries said that they already paid the price by losing their territories, also because of for their desire to move forward to the European Union and to join the EU. But for me personally, on the one hand, yes, there is this feeling of free riding, but I do know that both Georgia and Moldova have people who are very friendly to Ukraine. We have very many things in common, including common problems. Together we can solve them in a better way, As we did already within the associated TRIA, and as we did it already within the Eastern Partnership. So moving together is not the worst choice. It is a good choice. Also bearing in mind the EU sort of political tradition to accept countries, not one by one, but in groups. So I think that, yes, we can talk to Chișinău and to Tbilisi about what we think about sort of free riding. But strategically, it is very important to join our efforts and to move forward together to prove that the Eastern Partnership limbo is not the place for souls of Moldovans, Georgians, and Ukrainians anymore.
Yes, thank you, Sergei, for that. For their response as well. I think what's interesting is that what kind of I got out of what you were saying, especially in terms of Ukrainians, is that it's not only, the war that you are fighting is not only defending your land against the invader and the occupier, but at the same time, you also have something additional that you're fighting for. And this is, to be in the European Union. And so it was very strategic to submit the application for membership for the European Union because it's an added motivation to fight. I'm this is my kind of impression. I don't know if you agree with that. Maybe I just would like to follow up also with you, Sergei, and talk, if you could talk just a little bit more about the impact. You started talking about how some of these reforms are still taking place, but what do you think the impact of the war is going to have on this whole process of Ukraine's application? And how do you assess, how do you assess Ukraine's chances of being granted candidate status during the June European Council meeting?
We can talk about the procedure, the institutions, and the political will, as well as already mentioned public opinion. If we talk about the institutions, then we have full support of the European Parliament, which is the first step for gaining the candidate status. And therefore, I think that many Ukrainians do share the opinion of those who participated in the Conference for the Future to provide European Parliament with a wider competences, because if it was only the European Parliament to decide that, then certainly we would have even higher chances to join. Then the European Commission, and here it's not only about our desires, it's also about technical thing, but since Ukraine was able to provide the questionnaire quite fast, bearing in mind these circumstances, I do hope that the quality of the questionnaire was rather high, and I do expect that the European Commission would be in favor of the decision for the candidacy. So the final decision is to be made by Council, and here it's getting more complicated, because the Council should vote and there should be consensus among the member states regarding the future status of the associated countries and Ukraine in particular. That's why I believe many Ukrainians are very much in favor of the decisions of the Conference for the Future, because if it was about qualitative majority, then the chances would have been higher, and the chances that not a single country would veto the decision are a bit lower. But anyway, the expectations are very high, and it's good and bad at the same time. It's good because if the expectations are high, it motivates people on both sides in the EU and in Ukraine to do more. But it's also bad because if the expectations aren't met, then it would result in disappointment. And disappointment which can demotivate, which can hamper, which can put under the question the choice. Here in Ukraine, I don't think that even if there is a disappointment, it would lead to any radical negative consequences, like the decision not to continue with the EU integration. Because so far, it's sort of the only choice. Recently, I was participated in another conference, and we were talking about neutrality as an option. And my idea was that the war painted the world in black and white. And you cannot be really neutral in such situation, because if the choice is about your survival and your extinction, then you cannot be neutral. You cannot be in between, because it will mean that you are half extinct. So it wouldn't impact the desire to join the EU. But what it can impact is the level of reforms, and because the Eastern Partnership, the association agreement, the visa liberalizations were the triggers for the reforms. They were this sort of carrots that the government was provided by the EU and which accelerated the reforms. Plus, it was a great tool in the arms of civil society, because civil society could put the pressure on the government for proceeding with the reforms, referring to the public opinion and referring to the positive outcomes the reforms lead to. Of course, we should somehow manage the expectations, but the best option under the circumstances is, of course, providing the candidate status, because it would mean a lot. Except for all the arguments which I have already mentioned, it would be also a very strong message to Russia.
Yes.
It would mean that the EU is ready to take this, to take responsibility for this area. And it would be also a strong message to all candidate status or potential candidate status. It would mean that the EU is responsible for countries that are under its political gravity.
Yeah.
Tanya, I want to come back to you now, and I want to zoom out again a little bit and look at the Eastern Partnership in general as a as an initiative. So, of course, we know that there's 6 countries in the Eastern Partnership, but now 3 of them have applied to EU membership, so they have already jumped far ahead. And so what do you think will be the impact of these EU membership applications on the EAP as a collective, and how this whole constellation might change in the future because of it?
Thank you, Agnieszka. Indeed, this is it's a very important question, looking at the future of the region. With Ukraine and later Moldova and Georgia applying for EU candidate status, there have been many commentators speculating that this means this automatically would result in the termination of the Eastern Partnership. So the policy should be scrapped and that it doesn't have sense to exist anymore. There's, on the other hand, other people are proposing an EAP plus formula, but then it's not quite clear what would that mean. The situation indeed also for the region has been volatile. Belarus has suspended its participation. The trio has been going ahead. So indeed, there have been a number of development that have shaken the policy quite a bit. Now, in my opinion, it would be a very big strategic mistake to consider the EU candidate status and the Eastern Partnership policy as mutually exclusive, either one or the other. I think actually the two should be considered compatible. There should be the possibility to have EU candidate status and the EAP framework, precisely because they do offer similar but also different tools going towards the same direction. So I think the EU should be very wary of giving up a policy and its associated toolbox and structures, especially given that it has delivered results and supported democratic development in the neighborhood. I think we should not forget also that the other 3 countries are neighbors to the associated trio. So keeping the Eastern Partnership policy and possibly tweaking it, but still maintaining it, would assure coherence in the region, that I think it's essential to address common challenges. Sergi mentioned this earlier, the countries have many common problems that also would have common solutions, and also the possibility to continue identifying and working on best practices to address problems that are, as I said, common: corruption, the rule of law, but also connectivity, climate change, environment. If we think about, for example, the war in Ukraine and the environmental impact is having, and the fact that the main problems that are arising will have national but also regional solutions, the Eastern Partnership policy and architecture offer the framework to discuss and to address cross-border problems and problems that that would need the cooperation of the neighbors. Also, I think in times of tense relations among the neighbors, the multilateral Eastern Partnership framework continues to offer this mediated space for ongoing dialogue among politicians, public administration, civil society, other non-state actors as well. So it can also increase the chances for conciliation and negotiation. And also lastly, but not for a lack of importance, Azerbaijan and Belarus, for these two countries, the EAP multilateral track has been the only possible platform for dialogue. Even with Belarus suspending its participation, dialogue continues with civil society actors in the region. So I think investing in the democratic development of some countries at the expenses of others is not a functional approach to security, nor a good application of the European values that that EU is founded upon and that Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine are aiming towards. So I think ensuring the continuation of the policy would send also a very important message to the stakeholders in Armenia, but also to the democratically minded forces and actors in Belarus and Azerbaijan, that there are opportunities for them too, and that they're not left behind because the trio continues its path. And also given that the way I see it, maintaining the policy doesn't, it's something that adds to the relationship of the EU with the AA trio and doesn't take anything really away. So I think that would be really important and a strategic mistake, as I said, to give it up.
Mm. Yeah, Serhii, I want to maybe get your opinion on this as well. What do you think is the future of Eastern Partnership from Ukraine's perspective, or from your perspective as well, considering, as Tanya mentioned, you have now very different paths for the six members. But from Ukraine's perspective, two of the members are more closely aligned, let's say, to Russia. One, in particular, Belarus, is basically no different at this moment when it comes to the situation with Ukraine. But you also have Armenia, which is a member of CSTO and is under a lot of pressure from the Kremlin as well. So I'm curious what is your reaction to what Tanya has said, as well as your opinion on future of Eastern Partnership?
Well, that's a complicated question indeed. Really, I cannot foresee the future of the Eastern Partnership, because the situation is changing very dynamically, and it's not clear what would be the political decision in Brussels and in the national capitals of the EU member states. Well, actually, I didn't have the feeling that there is a clear vision of the Eastern Partnership future even before the full-scale invasion of Russia. And now the situation is getting even more complicated. But what I think is important is to preserve Eastern Partnership at least in the area, in the domain of civil society, because it is a great umbrella tool for civil society actors of all six countries, and the tool which provides those remaining democratic forces in Belarus with some additional capacities and additional things that can support them. It is a tool for those who are trying to achieve some reforms in Azerbaijan, in Armenia. And it is a hook that keeps these countries still connected somehow to the European Union. Because we said a lot about the fact that if Ukraine is not provided with a candidate status, it can demotivate. But let's imagine those people in Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Belarus, if they are denied even to have Eastern Partnership as a tool, what would be their motivation? And only for the sake of that, I think there should be the tool which keeps them on the European radar.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Good point.
Yeah, so I want to stay with you, Sergei, because sort of we have on the one hand the Eastern Partnership and the question of whether this should stay, but also the French president, Emmanuel Macron, recently suggested yet another format of cooperation, if you will, and he called for a European political community, which would sort of include both members and non-members of the EU in some kind of new cooperation format. And so what you that would in a way be instead of offering Ukraine EU membership. So what do you think of this idea in general, and how has it been received in Ukraine?
Well, it wasn't me. It was Karl Bildt who once said that Russia makes you proposal that you cannot deny, whereas the European Union makes you proposals that you cannot understand. I think that to some extent it's relevant for the proposal of the President Macron, because it is not clear yet what is really meant by this format. Is it again the good old story about common security space from Lisbon to Vladivostok? If yes, then it should probably consider even Russia as the EU neighboring country. Is it about security and prosperity belt around the European Union? Again, it's not clear. But it's clear that it's not about the countries which want to join the EU, because otherwise the UK wasn't on the list, but it is. So I think that first, it has to be really clarified. Second, the time it will take to clarify what do they mean, I believe will extend the period of President Macron's presidency. Perhaps it has to be combined with a conference on future of Europe decisions. Perhaps it has to be somehow reconsidered. But bearing in mind that it might take a long time to clarify what President Macron really wants and what France really wants from the format, it shouldn't prevent us from proceeding within the existing formats and within the existing procedures. So I think that it can be a good point for discussion, but it should not be an obstacle for granting candidacy to those who demand and to those who deserve it.
Tanya, I think the same question I would like to also ask to you as well. How was your reaction to this interesting proposal from Macron? And in addition to that, also is about generally Western European approaches to enlargement since February 24th and since this new development. We heard from Serhii that a lot of countries which may have been more reluctant in the past are very supportive of Ukraine now. So what is your sense and how you also react to the Macron idea?
Well, regarding the Macron idea, I share a lot of Sergei's thoughts, and I love the reference to the quote of Bildt. By the way, I think it's really appropriate to the this proposal and this scenario. I think regarding then more specifically regarding this proposal, this idea, I think the intentions behind were probably good, but then the details really need to be clarified. And I think it would be really important also to understand what added value would this European political community bring on top of what we already have provided by the existing structures, be them those that exist within the association agreement or the EAP multilateral framework, or possibly new ones then that pertain to the EU candidate status. So there's a very, very sparse information, very scant information about this idea. I know that he mentioned that there would be a space for political and security cooperation. Cooperation, he mentioned in the energy sector, transport, investment, infrastructure, youth. But these are areas where there is cooperation already and within the multilateral track, for example, and also bilaterally. So it remains unclear to me what would be the added value of this proposal, especially because it does not mention rule of law, democratic values in general, democratic reform, which is what would be also really needed under the EU candidate status framework and the areas that should be of main focus. So I think, yeah, a lot of more thoughts and details should be either revealed or elaborated when it comes to this proposal to see exactly what added value it would bring. Now, when it comes to, you ask about the EU.
Yes.
So regarding how Western European countries look at the question of EU candidate status for the trio, I think it's a bit tricky. We see that EU member states have been quite cohesive in their answer towards the war. It's been even unprecedented the way in which they reacted, which is a good testament to unified approach. But then I think on the EU candidate status question, it may be a bit different. I think at the level of EU populations, there is a lot of understanding and a lot of demonstrations of solidarity towards Ukrainians. But I think the tide can also turn as attention towards the conflict fades, because people get tired of hearing about the war every day. It's normal, unfortunately, in the cycle of news that less and less attention is paid to such tragic events. And I think it's then governments have to answer to people and take a temperature of the mood also in their country. And I see, and this is a concern of mine, that also discussions are changing. I'm native of Italy. I follow the debate there quite a bit, and I see a lot of Russian speaking points being repeated in the national TV, especially national media. A lot of public intellectuals that are not experts on Ukraine nor on Russia, but that are have been around for a while. They formed their opinion during Cold War times, have been fed for years the idea that Ukraine, Belarus, I mean, what are they? It's small Russians, you know, this sort of Soviet and now Russian idea. And it's very unfortunate, but, you repeat a thing, a false information 10 times or even 3 times, and it becomes true in people's minds. I must say, I think it's something this, how EU member states, Western EU member states, will approach this question. I think it can get tricky. I hope that there will be a pragmatic approach and understanding that this is it, offering EU candidate status is very important, also from a symbolic perspective and towards the people also of Ukraine, Moldova, and Georgia. But I think it's something that go as we think it will go on the basis of how they answered to the war so far.
Yeah, and I think this topic of disinformation and propaganda, I think we will see that definitely go even more. We will definitely see a lot of propaganda, disinformation activities in EU countries as this process goes forward. Which will definitely make it more difficult for countries for these countries to achieve the candidate status. So we are nearing the end of our discussion. I just wanted to ask Serhii if you had any last remarks or any last reactions to what Tanya said, or we'll just give you the opportunity to make a last closing statement if you'd like.
Well, it may sound banal and pathetic, but I believe that it still has to be repeated that the war of Russia against Ukraine is far more than the war of Russia against Ukraine. It's a Russian war against European values and against those who support them. Therefore, it's a common task to oppose Russian Federation, and therefore supporting Ukraine is supporting Europe and supporting European values. Although it sounds pathetic, the world itself is getting much more pathetic after February 24. And that's why I think that instead of post-postmodernist trends, we have to accept that we are back to basics and to consider it when making decisions.
This is maybe not a very upbeat note, but an important one, and we do need to remember it and take it into account. Tanya and Serhii, thank you so much for joining us for this discussion. I think it was incredibly interesting, and you've given us so many insights, and I'm sure our listeners will also appreciate everything that you do and everything that you've shared with us. So thank you once again for your time and for joining us on Talk Eastern Europe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And that was our interview with Tanya Marocchi and Serhii Gerasimchuk. We hope our listeners enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed this exchange. Our guests definitely have a lot of knowledge on the topic, and they did bring up some very important points. I think one point is for sure that it is an important development that these countries applied for this EU membership. And it would be important, especially in the case of Ukraine, that it does get this candidate status. I think it would be a very strong signal sent by the EU. So this is something definitely to be followed closely in the weeks and months to come. We have this upcoming European Council in June. Let's see what happens there, because as we said during the interview, this is not a straightforward situation. There's definitely not a 100% support for this, but perhaps this support could be built up. And then I think another important takeaway is that the fact that these countries applied for EU membership does not mean that the Eastern Partnership should stop existing. It might require some adjustments, it might require some changes, but overall, as an initiative, as a platform for cooperation, especially also with the countries that are not maybe so close with the EU, it is very important. And it is very important to maintain connection to the peoples in these different countries, to the civil societies. And this is one of the ways in which this can be done. So I don't know if you, Adam, perhaps have any other observations from the interview?
Yeah, just I think I just want to agree with you that I think the speakers were really great and knowledgeable and provided us some good perspective on what might be ahead for both the application process for the EU as well as the Eastern Partnership itself as an initiative. I think what we need to be watching closely will be how this process plays out within the European Union. Last weekend, the Polish President Andrzej Duda gave a speech at the Ukrainian Parliament, Verkhovna Rada, and he stated clearly that Poland, and I'm sure this goes for the other countries in the region, including the Baltic states, will advocate hard that they receive this candidate status. And then on the other hand, we have the Western European countries, particularly Macron in France, as we talked about during the discussion, that maybe not yet is the time for candidate status for these countries. Let's come up with an alternative, this political community, which nobody really understands what it's about. And I love the quote that Serhii gave, the Carl Bildt quote, which I've heard many, many times, but it's very relevant in this situation, in this context. So we will have to see how it goes. But I think there will be a bit of a divide in the European Union. And I think part of the negotiation process will be very internal. But for, you know, at least for Ukraine, the good news is that there are advocates for it within the European Union. And Poland, I mean, is a large country and is, I think, seen now as a very important player in this, you know, in this process and the region in particular. So it will be interesting to watch how this plays out.
Right. And I think with that, we can move to the last segment of our episode, which are announcements and our traditional shout out. So first of all, last week, we had an exciting event taking place. I don't know, Adam, if you want to mention it briefly.
Well, I don't know if our listeners, you might have missed it, but our last episode was our 100th episode. So it was a huge event for us. We decided to live stream it, which meant to also deal with all the technical issues that come with live streaming. But I think we managed. And it was a very interesting discussion about the history of the podcast, some unexpected situations that we had to deal with, as well as just what we see as going forward for Talk Eastern Europe and for the region. So please do check that out if you haven't listened to it, if you want to hear a little bit more of us in a more laid-back setting, let's say. Agnieszka was our interviewer, and Maciek and I were the interviewees, and she did a great job. So it was fun, and at the same time, I think it was also important to kind of take the moment and reflect on where we've been these past, you know, several years, 100 episodes.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was the host that almost didn't make it to the party, but in the end I did. So yes, I made it. And that was great. No, I really enjoyed it. It was so much fun to interview you guys and to then later on also interact with some of our patrons and some of our former guests. That was absolutely brilliant. So thank you to all who joined us. Thank you also to other listeners who joined us on that day. And yeah, you can still watch the recording or listen to it in a podcast format if you would like. It's on Facebook, it's on YouTube, and the podcast form, of course, it's wherever you find us normally. So yes, so that was a lot of fun.
And you mentioned, Aga, we had a small after party after the live stream with a Zoom event with our patrons. And that was, as you mentioned, very fun. Also very interesting because we had a guest from Ukraine, Maxim Kiak, who was giving us some, you know, basically direct information from you know, as the situation was unfolding. And Maxim messaged me right after we finished, the moment we said goodbye on the Zoom call, the air raid sirens went off where he was, and he had to get to the shelter. So we were lucky that that he was able to stay with us. Of course, Octavian was with us as well, and then several of our patrons. It was great to see you. So we hope to have more of these kind of discussions. And that also means that if you would like to be involved with the podcast on an even more direct level, we invite you to become a patron of the podcast. We are already at 33 patrons who are supporting us and have been supporting us for quite some time. And there are a lot of benefits to becoming a patron. Not only do you get a chance to have direct interaction with us, the co-hosts, but we also organize these types of events, online discussions on Zoom, which is exclusive for patrons, and additional content and discussions around the podcast are taking place with our patrons. But there's one very important benefit which our patrons do receive, and that's the traditional patron shout out.
Yes, and it will be my pleasure this week to do our traditional patron shout out. So we just wanted to say hello and a big, big thank you to all of our $5 and above and longtime patrons. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much for supporting us. And we hope to be able to interact with you as much as possible in the future. So thank you so much to David, Daniel, Carolina, Percy, RSJ, Anais, Stephen, Tom, PM, David, Olaf, CB, Klaus, Plamen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Wilhelm, David, Erica, David, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much to all of our patrons and to all of you out there who are listening to us. We do appreciate all of our listeners, and we are working on our next episode. So we will be with you again soon. And I think that's all we have for today. So until next time.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.